case for argument this morning is United States against Freeholm.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, this case arises out of the granting of a motion for summary judgment in an underlying ancillary proceeding that stemmed from a criminal prosecution. Really, the only issue for the Court to consider in this appeal is whether the District Court erred in entering its final order of forfeiture in the underlying proceedings based in part upon its granting of Cotswold's motion for summary judgment in the ancillary proceeding.
Mr. Boyer, I'm puzzled by why any of this matters. Is Freeholm a debtor in bankruptcy?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Linda Freeholm essentially ran a massive Ponzi scheme.
No, look. You say she's not a debtor in bankruptcy. Why not?
No.
Why isn't the United States, if no one else, commenced a bankruptcy proceeding? The reason I ask this question is because the issues you're trying to argue about holder in due course and so on are completely irrelevant in a bankruptcy proceeding. The giving of this mortgage interest would be a fraudulent conveyance set aside just like that in the bankruptcy because Freeholm was insolvent at the time she made the conveyance. And then all the issues we're talking about the availability of these assets to satisfy her fraudulent scheme, you know, the investors in her fraudulent scheme, instantly go away in a bankruptcy proceeding. Why don't you or any other creditor commence a bankruptcy and this will just be over like that?
Well, Your Honor, that wasn't done. I don't pretend to have an answer for the Court as to why we didn't proceed in that fashion. I think that under the circumstances of the case, the United States did proceed appropriately with respect to dealing...
It's because you're thinking criminal rather than thinking, how is it that we get these assets into the hands of the victims?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's more than that. I think that it's also, if you look at the facts that Cotswold was confronted with at the time it received its mortgage, it was not, and it did not have a reasonable basis to believe that the property was not subject to forfeiture, given the 8 months of dealings that it had with Linda Freeholm.
What about Powell Woods? He checked, Cotswold checked with his Powell Woods. Did Powell Woods have to give his money back?
Your Honor,
he was in early, so he's got a lot of return on whatever he, quote, invested, right?
I'm not sure what the extent of Mr. Woods'
investment. Let's assume he did. Let's assume he got 100% back of what he got put in. Has there been some basis for making him give back the money because it was a preference or because he took advantage of something, or does he get to keep his money?
The government didn't
go
do anything with
respect. So what's the difference between him and Cotswold?
Your Honor, as I understand what happened in the lower court, Mr. Woods and Cotswold's principal, Mr. Musani, met. Mr. Woods introduced Mr. Musani to Ms. Freeholm and sort of set him up in these investments. It's my understanding, based on the facts, that at the time Cotswold made its initial $100,000 investment with Ms. Freeholm, that either Mr. Woods or a group of people that Mr. Woods put together made an investment as well.
So they're all in the hole.
It's my understanding that that's correct, Your Honor, that they made this initial investment. Ms. Freeholm never made good on her investment. So I don't believe that Mr. Woods reaped the benefit of any investment that he made with Ms. Frickholm. So he's not in the same position
If they're still in the hole, no, he's secured with more than what he's put in, which is, as Judge Easterbrook points out, there are ways to get that, it would seem. This is a little strange.
With respect, Your Honor, there may be some other way to get the money. I didn't really look into whether it would be appropriate to proceed in bankruptcy.
Well, there's $14 million or something that's all told?
All told, it was close to $15 million.
Yeah, and they've gotten, is there $4 million accounted for? How much is recovered?
What is recovered, if you sort of globally look at everything, is there were some bank accounts in Europe that generated some funds. There were some automobiles. There was the house at issue here, which is 1982 North Lakeshore Drive. If you include that in the pot, that house is worth approximately $2.28 million. There was also a second home that Ms. Frickholm purchased in June of 1999 to the tune of about $1.5 million.
So there's about $4 million that's either spent, not spent, or given back to the quote investors. There's $4 million that more or less.
Well, no, Your Honor, it would be less than that because
the house.
The funds that would be considered allocated to the 1982 property have not been given to anyone. The funds that would be available would be from 1980 North Lakeshore Drive, which was the house that she purchased in June for $1.5 million, in addition to other funds that were forfeited by the government. So it is less than the $4
million. Okay.
In terms of Section 853N6B, which is the statute that the government submits is the one that is applicable here, in order to qualify as a bona fide purchaser for credit for value, Cockfall would have to prove, one, that it's a BFP, and two, that it was reasonably without cause to believe that the property was subject to forfeiture. In other words, that the property was not purchased with the proceeds of some type of a fraud. The government didn't challenge the BFP prong of that test in the district court and doesn't challenge that here. But what we're focusing on is whether Cotswold reasonably held the belief or was reasonably without cause to believe that 1982 North Lakeshore Drive was not subject to forfeiture at the time it extracted its mortgage from Ms. Frickholm. It's the government's position that based upon the information that Cotswold had at the time, that it had no reasonable basis to believe that the property was subject to forfeiture. There's been some talk about, in the briefs, about these two prongs merging together, so that if you simply meet the qualification of a BFP, the rest of the sentence really doesn't matter. It's the government's position that those two prongs are separate and that a claimant has to prove both by a preponderance of the evidence.
He has to prove what? That he didn't know?
Well,
that she got the house fraudulently?
It's our position, Your Honor, that when you look at the cases that actually interpret the second prong of 853N6B, that actual knowledge is not the standard. The standard is you look at what the person knew at the time it acquired its interest in the property. In other words, at this point, at the time that the mortgage was obtained, and it's based upon those facts, it would cause a reasonable person to sort of pause and say, I'm not dealing with somebody that's legitimate here. I'm dealing with somebody that is defrauding me.
Because they have no liens on their house.
Well, I think that's one significant aspect of it, Your Honor, because this house was purchased in January. Cotswold made its first investment in March. When you look through the title search, it was purchased close in time, and it was purchased with cash. Given everything that happened to Cotswold during the course of its 8-month involvement with Ms. Frickholm, it certainly had reason to question how she was able to purchase a home that was worth $2.28 million for cash.
You sell a bigger house. If somebody, I know personally, somebody sold a house in California and made so much profit on it that they were able to go buy another house for cash in another part of California.
The point is, Your Honor, that under the statute, you're still required to do some investigation to assure yourself that you're not acquiring an interest in forfeited property.
What part of the statute requires affirmative investigation to assure yourself that the assets aren't forfeitable?
Your Honor, when you read the second prong of the statute, reasonably without cause to believe that the property is not
available. That sounds like a requirement of affirmative duty to investigate.
Well, you can't be reasonably without cause to believe anything unless you do some type of looking into it.
What case would you rely on? What is your best case for the proposition that that sentence imposes, as a matter of federal law, an affirmative duty to investigate?
Of the cases that we cited, I would refer the court to United States versus Cortez. It's in our brief. I can give the court the cite now if it would like it.
What court is that from?
This is the United States District Court for the Southern District of Florida.
Any appellate authority? Of course, you've got appellate authority saying this isn't an independent requirement of federal law at all. There's Lavin in the Third Circuit.
Your Honor, I read the Lavin case to say, as with the other cases that we cited, that the courts look generally to state law to determine what the person's interest in the property is, in other words, if they're a BFP, but that you look to federal law to then make a determination as to whether the interest that they have is sufficient to defeat forfeiture.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kessler.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honor. If I may address a few of the issues that the court has raised already with Mr. Boyer. First, focusing on the Cuartas case, and I know we did address this. That's the case that the government deciding as to support their claim. In Cuartas, our claimant was an investor in the black market through a drug cartel. He got upset when his last investment did not come back. The fellow lived in Columbia, Your Honor, not the city in South Carolina either, or the university, in South America. And
talking about the detailed facts of district court cases won't get us very far. Let's worry about Wisconsin law. My major worry about Wisconsin law is, can one be a bona fide purchaser in Wisconsin when the transaction is a fraudulent conveyance?
I think under Wisconsin law, Your Honor, and the Wisconsin statute, which is referenced in our papers, is clear. The obligation on the part of the purchaser is to do a title search.
I'm not talking about obligations on the part of purchasers. My question is a transaction that is a fraudulent conveyance because made at the time when the transferor was actually insolvent, can that be a bona fide purchase for value under Wisconsin law? Ordinarily thinks that the doctrine of fraudulent conveyance is an exception to the BFP doctrine.
Yes.
It allows a clawback from people who would otherwise be BFPs.
Yes.
And so I'm just asking this as a matter of Wisconsin law. Does Wisconsin say we don't care that it was a fraudulent conveyance?
I don't know if Wisconsin does care whether it's fraudulent, Your Honor, because the cases under Wisconsin law seem
to indicate. But isn't that absolutely essential here?
Yes, it is.
If Wisconsin would say this is a fraudulent conveyance, there would be no BFP and no objection to the forfeiture, one might think.
But in this situation, Your Honor, even if Wisconsin law said that an additional step was necessary, and I don't believe it does, but if we are to look to the federal law to say that additional step is necessary.
I'm not worried about federal law or additional second steps. I'm just trying to figure out how Wisconsin would treat the transfer of a security interest in satisfaction of an antecedent debt when the transferor was actually insolvent at the time of the transfer. And there's no doubt whatever that Frickholm was actually insolvent at the time of his transfer.
Well, Frickholm had a lot of assets.
Made promises she couldn't keep.
That's true. She did. There were, as Your Honor indicated, though, earlier, the beauty of the transaction. So let me focus on Wisconsin law, because that's the question the court's asking. It would appear that at minimum, I would even suggest that the reasonably without cause to believe language, which the government's contending is part of federal law, in the forfeiture context, would be required on the part of the purchaser. And that is, so you have the case law and the statute in Wisconsin which indicates that a clear title search, in fact, Mr. Musani did a detective's report, hired a detective, talking about an affirmative action, Your Honor indicated where in any case law does it say that the purchaser has to do anything affirmatively. Mr. Musani did an awful lot of things affirmatively, and that included getting a detective's report. There was nothing, however, on the title search that indicated no lien, no encumbrance, no nothing. And according to my reading of Wisconsin law, and according to the...
Why wouldn't that just by itself send up all kinds of warnings?
Oh, Your Honor, just because there's no lien on a property?
$2.2 million...
That property could... It's not that... No one is claiming...
This is from somebody who was unable to pay...
checks
bouncing. The obligations and checks were bouncing.
That's true, Your Honor. And the Mr. Musani did an additional investigation into Frickham, and the district court said, although we're not sure if he had to do it, he did it anyway. But the fact that there is a title free and clear on a piece of property, the government doesn't claim that the money was, that a bag of cash was brought in. It claims there was no mortgage taken out. Well, of course there was no mortgage taken out if there is no mortgage on the title report. So the fact that somebody purchased a piece of property for $2.28 million doesn't mean that, as Judge Easterbrook indicated earlier, they didn't sell a house earlier to pay for it and they had cash to do that. This, too, is from an individual. I'm sorry. This is also, Your Honor, a time, this is the late 90s, when even according to the government's website, and unfortunately I guess you can find just about anything on the website these days, but it indicated that the type of scheme that Ms. Frickholm was involved in included billions of dollars in the United States alone just during this time period. Mr. Musani did not do an FBI investigation, which seems to be what the government is asking it to have done. It did what a reasonable person would have done in a commercial situation.
A reasonable person in a commercial situation, given an offer that is too good to be true, comes to the conclusion that it is not true.
And, Your Honor,
no one who would invest in this offer could conceivably be deemed reasonable.
But, Your Honor, that is true to a point, and the point is this, respectfully. No one states that Mr. Musani was not a victim in this case. The FBI agent, the U.S. attorney prosecuting the case, the documents submitted to the court regarding the list of victims in the case. No one claims Mr. Musani wasn't a victim here. He was duped like 225 other people. Mr. Woods, there is a Mr. Dixon, Merritt Dixon, and the case was before the district court as well. Mr. Dixon invested nearly $4 million with Ms. Frickholm. What's interesting, though, is that...
There have to be some people to illustrate or give rise to the adage, a fool and his money are soon parted. They stand up and identify themselves, and of course, Frickholm was fishing for suckers, and she found them, but it makes it very hard to describe the suckers as reasonable people.
Over a two-year period, she took in $15 million, Your Honor, and part of the research that Mr. Musani did was to find and speak to individuals, like Your Honor indicated, who had made money, who had gotten return, or was that Judge Mannion? I'm sorry. Who had gotten a return on their money.
One of them.
Part of the the scheme itself involves returning funds and saying, here you go, here's $25,000, here's another $25,000. That's why there is a restitution order below against Ms. Frickham for $10.7 million, not the $15 million, and $10.7 million. And if Cotswold's interest is upheld in this matter, because it appears that the government has not challenged or has settled with Mr. Dixon on his claim of $4 million, and interestingly, Your Honor, they did not make the argument of reasonable cause to believe when they challenged Mr. Dixon. But that would take out $5 million of the $10 million of the restitution. There is the MVRA, the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, which Congress passed for this situation. I'm sure when Ms. Frickham gets out, she's going to be doing some things to bring in some more money. And I believe that the restitution will be made available to them at the moment.
Given her history, that sounds like you're inviting her to start another
Ponzi scheme. No, not at all, Your Honor.
And use that to pay the restitution order.
Not at all. I'm just following what the government
has
claimed.
Not clear she has any sources of legitimate income.
Yes, I'm sure she will.
Or any prospects.
Well, she was teaching. She was in real estate development, all claimed to be legitimate sources of income.
I think she will have a lot of trouble finding business partners willing to deal with her.
That may be so, Your Honor, but nevertheless.
Unless, of course, the first thing she does is defraud them about her criminal history.
The standard that was used below, Your Honor, by the district court, the findings that the district court made indicating that Cotswold did everything that it reasonably could, that it met the standard of reasonably without cause to believe that the property on which it secured its mortgage was subject to forfeiture. We believe that the district court, based on the arguments presented, based on the case law presented to it, made the proper decision. Respectfully, unless there are other questions of me, Cotswold would respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the district court in all respects.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Kessler. Mr. Boyer, your time has expired. The case is taken under advisement.